Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Dolores Handy. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Boston University Center for the Study of Asia, titled Masculinity and Japan's Foreign Relations. Our speaker is Dr. Yumiko Mikanagi from the New School in New York City. We begin with an introduction by Boston University Professor of International Relations and Political Science, William Grimes.
Today we have Professor Yumiko Mikanagi, who taught for many years at International Christian University in Japan, is now at the New School in New York City, and she's a leading figure in the study of Japanese politics and foreign policy. And she's had a pretty interesting intellectual arc, having started with political economy of trade, and then moving into gender analysis in Japanese politics, having authored one of the standard Japanese texts on that, and now is trying to apply some of those issues to the study of foreign policy. She has a new book, which has just come out, called Masculinity in Japan's Foreign Relations, and that's what she will be speaking about today. So I'll turn it over to you, Yumiko.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks for inviting me here, and thanks for coming. It's been a while since I came here, and I'm just so happy to be you. It's so beautiful. I'm going to be sharing part of this book called Masculinity in Japan's Foreign Relations. And I feel a little bit apprehensive. I mean, I said this morning, too, talking about this book because when you talk about Japan today, then I think Tohoku earthquake and its aftermath seem to be more of a relevant topic. The quake, tsunami, and nuclear power plant failure caused the largest crisis in Japan in post-war history, and Japanese politics and policymaking may have been dramatically altered as a consequence. So any inquiries into the past may have become somewhat useless, but I would like to think that there's always an element of continuity between the past and the future, and thus my inquiry with the past hopefully remains helpful in our study of Japan and its foreign relations. I began working on this book project as I was interested in basically two questions concerning Japan's foreign policy and gender. The first question is that since mid-1990s, the Japanese government has been trying to increase overseas use of the self-defense forces, making a, in my view, radical departure from limited use of the SDF in the past. I call this shift from passive defense stance to an active defense stance. So what explains this change? And the second question, which will be the focus of today's talk, is that feminist international relations experts have been arguing that there is a strong linkage between masculinity and international relations, both as an academic discipline and practice. They have argued that international relations in the academic field reflecting masculine views and values. And foreign policies in various countries, especially the U.S., has a lot to do with values and attributes associated with masculinity. For example, the idea that the world is a dangerous anarchy within which states compete with one another for maximization power is a view linked to the way men view their own world. So my question was, if this linkage was true, is there any such connection between masculinity and foreign policy making in case of Japan? As construction of gender, both femininity and masculinity varies across cultures, and the way gender is constructed in Japan is indeed very different from the construction of gender in the West, I was not quite sure whether a feminist contention will hold in case of Japan. So in order to approach this question, there's sort of a dearth of literature on masculinity studies specifically focusing on Asian in general, but also specifically in Japan. So I had to find out how masculinity is constructed in Japan in the first place. As gender construction transforms over time, I also needed to extend my inquiry into the past. So I looked at rise and decline of dominant masculinity in Japan since Meiji period and its potential linkage with Japan's foreign relations. In today's talk, I will first present five types of dominant masculinity which appear from the 19th century Meiji Restoration. Then I will discuss ways to categorize various masculinities. In the end, I will present a rough sketch how these types of masculinities may be associated with Japan's foreign relations. In post-war Japan, salaryman has been the way of life for many Japanese men. But as we take a look at the historical evolution of dominant masculinity, salaryman is but one of many types of masculinity. There are at least five types of masculinity which became dominant since Meiji period. Before I continue, I'd like to clarify the use of the term dominant masculinity. I use the term dominant masculinity to mean something similar to R.W. Connell's hegemonic masculinity. According to Connell, in a given society at any moment, there are multiple types of masculinity which could be called hegemonic, subordinate, and marginalized. Just for information, Connell's definition of hegemonic masculinity means, and I quote, "the configuration of gender practice which embodies the currently accepted answer to the problem of legitimacy of patriarchy, which guarantees the dominant position of men and the subordination of women," close quote. In my analysis of masculinity in Japan, I was interested in locally dominant masculinity as opposed to globally dominant hegemonic masculinity discussed by Connell. In order to make the distinction between the two, I created a term, dominant masculinity, and used this term throughout the book. It means a set of symbols, attributes, behaviors, lifestyles, and values agreed by large numbers of people in a given society as manly and ideal. Simply stated, dominant masculinity means successful ways of being a man in a particular culture at a specific time. Now, moving on to the discussion of types of dominant masculinity, the first dominant masculinity which emerged soon after the Meiji Restoration is what I call Haikara masculinity right there, number one. Haikara is a term, it's a combination of English words high and color. And color is comes from Western shirts worn by Meiji leaders, roughly meaning Western chic. So Western civilization introduced by the Meiji government brought about dramatic changes to Japan. In terms of visible changes, people's lives are affected in every aspect of their quotidian lives. In terms of clothing, for example, Western clothing such as tailcoats and top hats for men and dresses for women are introduced. Both men and women changed to Western hairstyles. Men sported facial hair and women wore makeup. Western architecture began to change city landscapes and the Japanese people began to consume Western food such as meat and dairy products. In addition, invisible changes occurred as in the flow of Western knowledge such as technology, science, and political and legal systems, which in turn transformed people's lifestyles, values, norms, and ideals. These visible and invisible changes included changes in the way gender was constructed. The most symbolic of all the changes that took place during this time regarding masculinity was the renunciation of swords by former samurais. And it was a big symbolic change as swords were not only arms to kill others, but were, more importantly, symbols of power, as samurai was the class of legitimate rulers until then. What appeared in place of samurai masculinity, which was the dominant masculinity in Japan before Meiji Restoration, was a carefully studied, civilized masculinity of the European and American ruling classes. Government officials who were at the heart of the civilization and enlightenment movement, or Bunmei Kaika, studied or imitated Western manners and fashion through their direct contact with Western societies, but also through reading numerous etiquette books, or what contemporary Japanese would call manuals, and the most famous of which is Fukuzawa Yukichi's Seiyo Ishokuju, the title in English is Western Clothing, Food, and Houses, published in 1867. While the new Japanese gentleman of the early Meiji period was obsessed by the material aspect of Western civilization to the point of superficiality, the coming of Haikara masculinity signified a serious change in the ways in which dominant masculinity was constructed in Japan. The rise of Haikara masculinity to the position of dominant masculinity meant that men who aspired to maintain or gain power needed to reinvent themselves as westernized gentlemen in terms of both style and identity. To be a man of power in New Meiji Japan, therefore, meant intimate knowledge of Western culture, including fluency in Western languages, mastery of etiquette and manners, which included respectful treatment of ladies, and the attire of Western gentlemen. Because the new elites had to deny everything related to samurai culture, the rise of haikai culture masculinity meant that the ethos of samurai masculinity, such as excellence in martial arts and extensive knowledge of Chinese classics, lost their value as constitutive elements of ideal masculinity. Moving on to the second type called bankara masculinity. Bankara is a play on the word haikara, with ban meaning barbarous. In 1874, Itagaki Taisuke, a samurai from Tosa Domain, which is now Kochi-ken and Shikoku, and his men initiated a political opposition movement called Freedom of People's Rights Movement called Jiyu-Menken Undo. These men demanded enactment of a constitution and establishment of a national assembly, at the same time challenged those in power by presenting the new type of masculinity which deliberately resurrected images of rough and violent samurai. The purpose of this was to make westernized haikara gentlemen look meek, cowardly, and even effeminate. Thus, bankara men rejected then fashionable western attire and instead adopted a style which resembled drifter samurai or ronin, wearing torn kimono and traditional wooden clogs called geta. The rough and sometimes violent attitude and traditional attire were used as symbols of the new masculinity with the clear intention to cast westernized Meiji men as too effete to be the legitimate rulers of Japan. So moving on to the third masculinity called Kyoyoshugi masculinity, and Kyoyoshugi roughly translates to self-cultivation principle. In the early 20th century, the spread of Kyoyoshugi among the intelligentsia and prestigious Kyusei Koko or old higher schools students marked a renewed commitment to Western culture. In contrast to bankara masculinity of the mid-Meiji period, the masculinity shared among elite students was less focused on physical toughness and violence and more on self-cultivation, emphasizing the pursuit of knowledge in academic fields such as Western literature, culture, philosophy, and art. Study of foreign languages, German in particular, formed the core of their curriculum, and these students were able to read and recite original European literature such as von Goethe and von Schiller. As many of these students were from the most prestigious higher schools called Ichiko, who formed the core of political and business elites upon graduating from universities, their masculinity was once shared by the ruling class of the period and was the dominant masculinity above all other types of masculinity and considered to be an ideal by many. And the fourth one is called men as soldiers masculinity. As Japan entered Pacific War, every person was expected to defend and die for the nation, or more precisely, the emperor. The wartime dominant masculinity was about men serving in the Imperial Army and Navy, which I call men as soldiers masculinity. While Japan entered war in China in 1937 officially, this masculinity was slow to emerge as the new dominant masculinity because elite high school students despised soldiers. They used the German words Soldat, but you know, they called them Zoru, and it was in a very condescending way. And they kept the distance from Japan's militarism and continued to espouse Kyoyoshugi masculinity. Men as soldiers masculinity had replaced Kyoyoshugi masculinity only when the entire nation was militarized in the early 1940s, when the government decided on mobilization of students who were previously exempt from conscription in 1943. Moving on to the post-war period, last dominant masculinity to emerge in Japan's history was called salaryman masculinity. Japan's defeat in World War II and the subsequent Allied occupation brought about extensive political, social, economic, and cultural changes aimed at demilitarizing and democratizing Japan. What could have caused tremendous change in the construction of gender was the effort made by the occupation authorities to transplant a democratic American-style nuclear family ideal in place of pre-war IE system, which is a multi-generational family structure with its head having tremendous and often oppressive authority over its members. In short, the occupation authorities sought to transform Japanese men from imperial soldiers and authoritarian heads of iye to loving and caring fathers. Instead of accepting this American ideal as the new dominant masculinity, however, as Japan entered a high economic growth period in the latter half of the 1950s, a new type of masculinity began to emerge. With the coming of Japan's economic quote-unquote miracle in the late 1950s and 1960s, salarymen who displayed loyalty, diligence, dedication, and self-sacrifice became the most desirable male role model and gained dominance over other types of masculinities. A salaryman is typically a white-collar worker who is a graduate of a four-year college and works for a company that offers him a lifetime, in quotation marks, employment with the wage that increases with seniority. He is heterosexual, or at least has to maintain the appearance of heterosexuality, and expected to marry in his mid to late 20s and create a family. As he is expected to be dedicated to work, and his company may send him away to a remote branch offices, he and his wife would observe a traditional division of labor in which he focuses on his job and she focuses on housekeeping and child rearing. So moving on to categorizing these types of masculinity that appeared in Japan's history. So are these types of masculinity, were they all different from one another, or were there any similarities? In an effort to understand if there is any pattern in the rise and decline of dominant masculinities, I will introduce two different concepts used in the discussion of masculinity in Japan. These concepts are not common in academic discussions, yet they appear often in writings and spoken Japanese in reference to men, boys, and masculinity. The first is a category used to describe the different types of masculinity that exist in Japanese society in general. The first one is koha, or hard faction, hard masculinity. I just translated hard masculinity. Anampa means soft faction, and I just call it soft masculinity in English. And every Japanese person knows this, they have the vague image of what these words mean. These distinctions emerged as early as early 20th century. And you see a novel written by a famous novelist, Mori Ogai. And Mori Ogai, in his famous novel, Vita Sexualis, he published in 1909, the distinction between koha and nampa is primarily the willingness to display sexual desires. Ogai writes that men who subscribe to hard masculinity do not dare to look at pornography in public, whereas men who just subscribe to soft masculinity, or nampa men, read pornographic books openly. Ogai further states that differences in koha and nampa were also seen in their postures. While both koha and nampa students address similarity in their long kilts and what you see in the previous images, koha men had a way of showing their rough masculinity by, and I quote, rolling up their sleeves and standing square with their shoulders slightly raised. And this posture may not make sense to us, not just among contemporary Japanese, but the Westerners, but this posture was meant to be menacing. Granted that there is a variation across historical periods, the general koha is associated with physical toughness, muscular body, roughness, athleticism, and sometimes violence. Nampa, in contrast, is associated with a slim body, sleek hairstyle, sophisticated clothing, and sociability. As for sexual orientation, neither koha or nampa is explicitly heterosexual or homosexual. However, as Ogai stated, there is a clear difference between these two in terms of the degree to which heterosexual socialization is acknowledged and demonstrated. The hallmark of koha is its emphasis on the valorization of sexual stoicism, the socialization among men and rejection of fraternization with women as expression of self-control. Taken to an extreme, some koha men displayed misogyny. By contrast, a major component of nampa is unabashed socialization with women, which sometimes manifests itself as promiscuity. Nampa men take pride in their smooth courting techniques with women and sophisticated taste in fashion and in their lifestyles, which in part are intended to overtly appeal to women. Relationships with women may be the most obvious distinction between Kohan and Nampa, yet another distinction between the two is the difference in attachment to athleticism and physical development. Kohai is associated with serious attention to stoic physical discipline, such as thus making Kohai men play hardcore sports, such as martial arts and baseball. Nampa men, on the other hand, tend not to emphasize disciplining themselves as much, but rather interact with women and engage in sports only to mix with or impress women. While the distinction between Kohai and Nampa is used to refer to boys, men, and masculinity in the general society, there is a special concept reserved to describe the ideal or dominant masculinity, and namely, bunbu ryodo. And this concept, bunbu ryodo, is often used to complement manly and gifted or successful men and boys. Kam Lui, who wrote this very interesting book called Theorizing Chinese Masculinity, published in 2002, talks a lot about this Chinese concept of wen wu, which is basically the same as bun. Wen is a Chinese bun, and wu is bu in Chinese. And like they argue, the ideal masculinity, like in China, the ideal masculinity in Japan has always combined both bun and bu masculinities. It is interesting that this construction of ideal masculinity is strongly influenced by Chinese conception of ideal manhood, and the evidence of which is that excelling in bun historically meant proficiency in kanbun, which is a Japanese method of reading annotated classical Chinese literature. However, in contemporary usage, bun, or wen in Chinese, means having wide and deep knowledge and excellence in the fields of art and literature in general. Art could mean both Western and traditional art, as in Western painting and music, or calligraphy, haiku, and tanka, on the other hand. Literature, again, could be both Western and Japanese. And in the broadest usage, it could include all academic subjects. If bun masculinity is about excellence in the attainment of knowledge, bun masculinity is about physical development, not dissimilar to Kohai's or hard masculinity's emphasis on hardcore sports. Bun masculinity has historically been associated with martial arts such as judo, karate, and kendo. But in the contemporary usage of the term, however, the meaning has expanded to include excellence and dedication not only to traditional sports, but also to Western sports such as baseball and rugby. As in China, ideal masculinity has to entail both bun and bun masculinities. However, the weight given to bun or bu element in the dominant masculinity has varied over time. Our overview of dominant masculinity indicates that some variants of dominant masculinity, such as haikara kyoyoshugi and salaryman, place heavier emphasis on the bun component, whereas in the Bankara men as soldiers masculinities, the bu component was much more important. There's a certain overlap between the types of masculinity in the general society, that is the distinction between Kohai and Nampa, or hard and soft masculinities, and the types of dominant masculinity of the society, the bun and bu types of bun-bu masculinity. Namely, dominant masculinity when the emphasis on bu qualities belong to the category of Kohai or hard masculinity, and the dominant masculinity with emphasis on bun qualities belongs to the category of Nampa or soft masculinity. In order to distinguish the two different types of bun-bu masculinity or the ideal masculinity, I will call the first one with an emphasis on bu element, warrior masculinity, and the second one with the emphasis on bun element, literati masculinity. It is important to note that while warrior masculinity belongs to the Kohai or hard masculinity category and literary masculinity belongs to the Nampa category or soft masculinity category, we must keep the bun and wu distinction, hard and soft distinction, separate. This is because hard and soft masculinity distinction is applicable to all types of masculinities in Japan, whereas warrior literary distinction is applied to the bun-bu masculinity, and thus to dominant and ideal masculinity only. Certainly, the warrior and literary types of dominant masculinity draw from traits in the hard and soft masculinities in the broad society, respectively. Yet to be a dominant masculinity, both warrior and literary masculinities must incorporate both boon and boo qualities. That is to say, warrior masculinity must incorporate some boon qualities, and literary masculinities must incorporate some boo qualities. And this duality makes warrior and literary masculinities unique and somewhat apart from the simple, hard, and soft masculinities in the general society. Going back to the question I presented earlier, do we observe a linkage between construction of masculinity and foreign policy in Japan? The book shows that masculinity may be associated with aggression, violence, and competitiveness, as imagined by feminist international relations scholars focusing on Western cultures. But there are other types of masculinity which came to dominate Japanese society in the past. Thus, in Japan, the close relationship between dominant masculinity and physical toughness or violence appears to wax and wane. To be sure, dominant masculinity always entails both elements of boon and boo, as I just mentioned. Yet, illiterati masculinity, with an emphasis on knowledge rather than physical strength and violence, often became dominant in Japan's modern history. In fact, we see that the dominant masculinity in Japan has altered between warrior masculinity and literati masculinity. Thus, Meiji Heidegger masculinity with less emphasis on boo qualities categorizes literati masculinity, in my view, was challenged and displaced by a more warrior-type masculinity, bankara masculinity, by the mid-1890s. After the Russo-Japanese War, bankara masculinity was replaced by kyoyoshugi masculinity, again with less emphasis on boo than boon qualities, so a type of literati masculinity. In the 1940s, men as soldiers masculinity, a warrior masculinity obviously, came to the center stage. With the end of World War II and the sweeping reforms undertaken by the Allied occupation, men as soldiers masculinity was replaced by salaryman masculinity, which emphasized knowledge and technology more than physical strength, and thus a variant of literary masculinity. Roughly speaking, the alternation between warrior and literary masculinities appeared to be associated with the way Japan relates to the world. During the early Meiji period, as Japan's political elites were pursuing improvement of relations and equality of status with Western powers, Haikara literary masculinity was dominant. However, Haikara masculinity was replaced by Bankara masculinity, warrior masculinity, when Japan's relationships with the international world became increasingly competitive and militarized, kept by two major wars, the Sino-Japanese and Russo-Japanese Wars. After Japan's triumph in the Russo-Japanese War, Kyoyoshugi literary masculinity became dominant, and it formed a cultural backdrop for Shidehara diplomacy of the 1920s, a relatively cooperative way Japan related with major powers in the world. Of course, this literary masculinity was taken over by a more militarized man and soldiers' warrior masculinity as Japan entered the Pacific War. And during most of the post-World War II period, Japan's international relations focused heavily on economic ties with other nations, and Japan maintained relatively cooperative and peacefully relationship with other nations. During this period, salaryman literary masculinity gained dominance and remained dominant until the early 1990s. Through a quick overview of transformation of dominant masculinity in Japan, we have seen that dominant masculinity in Japan fluctuated between warrior masculinity and literary masculinity, and that the alteration between the two accompanied shifts in Japan's foreign relations. But I am not claiming any kind of very clear causal relationship between the two, that is, the construction of gender, rise and decline of masculinity on one hand, and Japan's foreign relations on the other hand. The linkage between the two just seem to be quite interactive and complex. So I don't claim to have presented a very clear and parsimonious theory or anything here, but we do see what we see is an association or a synchronized shift in the two. So what do all these mean to Japan today? It is clear that salaryman masculinity has lost its dominant position, and especially since the 1990s, and I really do not have a clear view as to what is on the rise. One may say that the next dominant masculinity is even softer literary masculinity as represented by soshokuke danshi, or herbivore men. At the same time, this is more recent, but Mr. Ishihara won his fourth term as Tokyo's governorship this Sunday, And this may suggest that Japan's current crisis could generate a call for a warrior-type masculinity which emphasizes strong leadership and traditional manliness, if not violence. But will that lead to militarized foreign policy? My view is that the chance that Japan will develop nuclear arms is now close to zero. Yet having seen strong and effective American troops in Operation Tomodachi, Japan may continue to expand the role of the SDF as it has since mid-90s and making the U.S.-Japan alliance even stronger. Thank you.
Thanks very much. We have a lot, we've covered a lot, and there's probably a lot of questions, but since I have the microphone, I'm going to ask the first one. It's what I want to understand is how does the idea of masculinity as a driver of foreign policy give you a different story from thinking about it in terms of status politics? And in particular, how also how sort of internally generated normative changes in Japan in terms of the way in which families work and people work in distinction to each other are having effects through bureaucracies and policymaking processes and out into foreign relations beyond these sort of broader categories.
I can't tell you how that these values, you know, internalize, translate into foreign policy making. It's just that we have to know that any decisions one makes, every person, or be it politician, or you, or me, anybody, will cannot be isolated from the values and perspectives and the ideas that you internalize, right? So, and then I'm not claiming that you can scientifically prove that. But the reason I skipped all those details, of course, and talking about how they appear to be connected, is that I was really struck by Japan's foreign policy making of the post-war period, which did not really conform to the traditional, views of IR scholars. And Japanese policymakers do not seem to look at the world the way that, say, like IR realists are saying that, realists are saying that, states compete against each other and they have this, they make decisions on their own and try to maximize power, whatnot. But war is actually the area where states freely make alliance. I'm talking balance of power theory, this idea of this freely acting states did not really make any sense in the context of Japanese politics. And I was really studying this foreign policymakers' statements and prime minister statements about the world, not necessarily any specific foreign policy, but their worldview. And it struck me that they all seem to think that the world is a structure. There is a very clear structure. At the top is, during time in Cold War, it was Soviet Union and the U.S. And Japan belonged to this large corporation, capitalist corporation, with a CEO called United States. And we, meaning the Japanese people, belong to one of those salary men. And we just have to strive to please our boss and then think about going up this ladder from this, the peon salaryman to the section head. So they're constantly talking about status. We want to raise our status. We want to make sure that people see that we're doing our best to raise our status. And then the language really indicated that they're thinking very similar to a salaryman. I mean, the conversation, the way they speak about the world and the position of Japan really closely resonated with salaryman's view of his position in the company. This is a circumstantial evidence, right? I'm not really saying that this really proves this is how policymakers view the world, but the thing is that resemblance so close that I was thinking this is how the Japanese policymakers really internalize the views of this, what I call dominant and masculine desire or masculinity, and then reflect that upon foreign policy making.
And can I just follow up with one other quick thing, which is the masculinity, as you described it, is doesn't seem to be very gendered. And it doesn't seem to have a sort of a counter to ideas of femininity on the part of some other actors in the international community. And let me just give you a sort of a quick sense of where this is coming from for me, because I'm really not in the field. But I remember a few years ago I was in Korea, and I was getting a lot of very contradictory statements. One was, Japan is inherently militaristic and dangerous. But the other was, and I must have been told this by a dozen people in the space of a day and a half independently, was, don't you think that Korea is masculine and Japan is really feminine? And it seemed to be very meaningful to these people, many of whom were quite educated, in the way in which they understood how Korea and Japan could and should interact. And so I'm wondering where the, you would define this carefully as masculinities rather than as gender politics, but I wonder if you can pull us back to gender or pull us into gender and give us a sense of how this works in you know, your vision.
I love this question. I urge you to read Kam Lui's fantastic book, The Study of Chinese Masculinity, because that's very, I mean, what I'm going to say is really a take on from what he was saying is that you're speaking from your understanding of what is feminine and what is masculine. So you're saying that, well, Japan is feminine because they don't really have this effective military and Japan is not acting aggressive.
This is the Korean point of view.
Okay, but whatever the point of view, I mean, not yours, but, you know, is, you know, it's, you have a certain idea what masculinity and femininity is about, and probably this is really about, well, how Americans view or Anglo-Americans view what femininity is all about, masculinity is about, and this is the I'm criticizing this Western international relations theory, is that there is masculinity is ABC. Masculinity is about competitiveness, aggressiveness, violence, blah, blah, blah. And this is related to American foreign policy. Look at Ronald Reagan, look at George W. Bush. This is all about American masculinity. But I'm sort of rebelling against this and saying that, well, you may think the Japanese say salaryman masculinity is feminine, but that's because you're applying this American in a paradigm. But seen from the Japanese perspective, salaryman could still be masculine, but in its own way. They may not show this physical toughness. When you look at, you go to Japan, see those like tired, you know, scrawny Japanese salaryman, and there's nothing masculine about this if you use the Western perspective. I mean, I always look at them as like, do they ever exercise? Do they ever eat? And why? What makes them so masculine? Why do they think that they can be a man? But that's because I have Westernized, you know, gender perspective. But I think gender could be gender is constructed in a very in a local way, and I am still talking about gender construction seen from within Japan. So salaryman is seen by both Japanese men and women is still about construction of a certain type of masculinity.
Thank you for your fascinating talk. I'm actually working now on some post-war, like early post-war masculinity, more in kind of consumer culture. And one of the things, I guess, I was interested in this distinction you make between dominant and hegemonic, which I think I can see some real useful ways that that could be interesting, particularly in the example you just used of paying close attention to the local and the ways in which, local masculinities don't articulate necessarily clearly with a kind of global dominant masculinity. But I guess one of the things I would sort of want to hear your take on is the ways in which dominant masculinities actually make use of kind of more global discourses. I'm thinking of, you know, stuff in the 50s where one of the greatest ways to rebel against your parents, this is not the 60s, like get out in the street and protest, but in the 50s was to adopt, you know, Hawaiian shirts and to take on a kind of a masculinized, these are kids born in the post-war period who are adopting aspects of a sort of Americanized masculinity, not so much because they want to, be American per se in their ideal, but this was a great way to flip their nose at their parents. And I wonder possibly the dominant versus hegemonic thing are actually intertwined in really important ways rather than sort of two completely distinct things.
I can't agree more. I mean, you're absolutely right. And even it's not, like dating back to earlier period in the 19th century, or even before that, people had ways of learning what a manly man should be like, right? And when, black ships came in Japan, and so this really powerful Western man and his, Meiji leaders learned a lot from what a man should be. So therefore, Hayakawa masculinity, right? I mean, I really didn't mean to tell you what process really came, gave rise to, say, Hayakawa masculinity, why does Kyusei Koko higher school students really wanted to go back and then go away from Bankara to something else. And there's tremendous interaction between the global exchange of information. And we're not talking the internet. I mean, this is a time that the communication was slower and they're learning from books and a lot of it's like German literature and this romanticized version of the Cavalier. And of course, I mean, it's always hybridization. So I'm making this picture very simple. And I know that there is a whole lot more, and I'm just hoping that this very small book will become something, a basis of future investigation, because hybridization is something that happens, and glocalization, of course, with sociological, is happening on a constant basis. And even the salaryman masculinity, even though this looks genuinely Japanese, but then all the salaryman could incorporate this Western notions of what is like cool, kakoi man. And today, it's much more so. The process is accelerated, right? Because these kids learn a lot from YouTube and internet streaming and whatnot. So, in reality, this hegemonic masculinity and locally dominant masculinity, there is no clear distinction. And also the formation interactive. And it's interesting that, that it's not just one way, influence that... I've been talking to current students who are interested in Japanese politics, and they enter Japanese politics from pop culture. And they, the entry point is so different from back when we were students, you were studying Japan because you're interested in the rise of Japan as the economic center or whatnot. But now, people are interested in anime and manga, all sorts of things. And then they are when you talk to these students, they're constructing their own image as a man or a woman through the images of manga and cartoon, and so that happens either way, and I don't know if it happened all the time or is more of a current phenomenon, but it is certainly a hybridizing process that I probably should be more it should be investigating from now onwards. I really agree. That's true.
Well, the other thing I was thinking with your 90s question marks was also maybe the ways in which, the category of Japan is under such incredible strain right now, and the discussions particularly around things like immigrant politics, so that it's not just a masculinity, it's a nationality. I mean, it always is. Mm-hmm. These are inflected always together. But to me, one of the things that was interesting about the 90s was this switch from, how do we make women have more babies, to how do we make men become good papas?
Mm-hmm.
And all this kind of new daddy discourse that really got going in the late 90s and then around the 2001 Angel Plan.
Yeah.
And so you really have, I think, a transformation in that idea of separate spheres or roles. I think is even the state is pushing more, more of a blending. Mm-hmm. And I think that is one of the things that's going to transform. That kind of breaking down of that barrier is also, I think, happening at the exact same time that the breaking down of, or I don't want to say breaking down, but there's a more kind of a demand on the part of many companies and chambers of commerce and whatever about making the borders between Japan and others more porous because of labor needs. and inviting in immigrants. So you're having a kind of breaking down of what seemed to be, for the most of the post-war period, a kind of, you know, the set reference points for gender, right, of home and work, and then also of Japan and others. And I just wonder how you see maybe the 90s and onward as those processes being reflected in foreign relations, ways in which Japan can't kind of necessarily maintain the same kind of being a subject or being a sovereign subject in international relations in the same way that men can't be the kind of sovereign subject they were, you know, in the 50s and 60s anymore. Sorry, that's a big question.
Well, I put those question marks because I really don't know clear answers to any of your questions. But one thing I was thinking is the coming of DPJ really meant was it happened in for a variety of reasons, many, many different people had different reasons why they wanted LDP to go. And obviously, there are always reasons, right? Economic issues, and people were just so not happy. The recession was going on forever, and Heisei's lost decade became lost 2 decades, and you never know. I mean, you don't really see a light at the end tunnel. I mean, that's the primary reason. But then again, there are like other levels, which may or may not be true, but also the gender part is that, so old LDP really represented all types of men and male politicians. And I think younger generation got so tired of not being able to feel affinity. Like there is this big gap between this like Ozawa type, even though Ozawa is not even an LDP guy, but you know, like, you know what I mean? Like you know, Tanaka Ozawa is like, I'll get this done. I don't want to explain. No, men don't explain anything because I'm a samurai, so the silence is gold. You know, that type of, you know, man to somebody that they can feel affinity with. And originally, I think Hatoyama had some popularity because symbolically he sort of represented like a newer generation. Like, you know, you see him in person, he dresses in chic Armani and his sleek body and he's like well-groomed and fashionable, urban and whatnot, right? I mean, of course, I mean, as a politician, he just didn't prove to be all that effective. But, you know, the rise of Hatoyama really signified that the people, especially younger people, were looking for somebody who can represent their like idea of gender, an idea of masculinity, or like a man who can trust, who can be part of them and lead them. But sort of like failure and weakness and inefficacy of DPJ really sort of like brought them all those ideas about gender back to square one. Because now that people are saying, oh, maybe LDP was not that bad. I mean, these older guys.
Yeah,
Ishihara, you know, like 70-something year old, and he's old. But then, you know, like those older, you know, guys who are just like very manly, and they led this Japan's high economic growth, and they're like our fathers and our grandfathers, and they're reliable, and they can be the chief breadwinner. Because what's happening related to what you said earlier is declining birth rate. People talk about this a lot. I mean, I just was at AAS, and everybody's talking about this. Government's doing everything wrong. I mean, they're trying to help married couples and especially working mothers continue their work and have children, right? And they're giving extra money so that they can, or like extension of daycare or paternal and parental leave and longer and compensation for this, whatnot. But the real problem is that people are not getting married. And in Japan, the single motherhood, especially unmarried mothers, totally social taboo. So it's either you change that or somehow you change that you can have women, you can let women have children without ever getting married, or somehow encourage this people to get married and have children, right? I mean, but government's not really looking at this. They're looking at people who are properly married in a traditional way and produce children. So I don't know. The old LDP idea of gender is still very old-fashioned. That I think a lot of like younger women in their reproductive ages, whatever that is, you know, just do not feel like the government is either DPJ or LDP is answering their needs. And that part has to be addressed. But that really needs an incredible change in the way how gender, ideal femininity, ideal masculinity is constructed in Japan. And I just don't know how that happens unless government will launch this extensive campaign, say, ladies, forget about getting married. Forget about getting married. I mean, it's fine if find boyfriends or husbands, but if you think the biological clock is ticking, just go ahead and have babies. We'll take care of you. And that really is, you know, really very closely related to construction of ideal femininity, right? But the counterpart of that is that to release men from the traditional construction of masculinity to be the chief breadwinner, and you don't have to do this. I mean, and you know, you can be with your partner, girlfriend, whatever, but you know, you don't really have, because currently the reason why people are not getting married or delaying marriage is because they're stuck with this old-fashioned idea that men will have to be the chief breadwinner, or he will have to be making more money than she does. And that's not happening because there's long-term recession, restructuring, and whatnot. So, you know, so long as they are stuck with this old construction of gender, this declining birth rate is not going to happen, except if Japan opens the doors to massive immigrants.
Thank you very much. This has been fabulous. It's a lot of interesting ideas, and I have to say that these are not things I think about every day. But that's one of the reasons why I wanted to invite you up when I saw that you put the book out. And as always, you've made me think a lot, and I think this has been a wonderful opportunity to consider these issues and to rethink some of the ways in which we understand masculinities in Japanese politics and Japanese foreign affairs. So at that, we'll close. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You have just heard a lecture by Dr. Yumiko Mikanagi from the New School in New York City. Dr. Mikanagi's lecture was titled Masculinity and Japan's Foreign Relations and was presented by the Boston University Center for the Study of Asia. Tonight's moderator was Boston University Professor of International Relations and Political Science, William Grimes. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth, with help from Paul Vikas. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Dolores Handy. Thanks for joining us.